Let me introduce our first speaker, Secretary Selena Bussey, and she's going to be talking about New Mexico jobs today. Just to give you a little background about her, she returns to the Department of Workforce Solutions, where she began her career in state government. Recently, she was director for the Northern New Mexico Independent Electrical Contractors. Prior to working with the Contractors Association, she was the state director of apprenticeships with what we used to call Department of Labor. And so that gives her a real interesting connection with Dr. Lerman, who's talking about apprenticeships. She's born and raised in Albuquerque, and she got her Bachelor of Arts in Political Science and Communication from UNM. And she's going to tell you about her vision of the department. I'm sure some of those of you that work for her know this, but it's to become more engaged with the business community and to promote the vast array of employment-related services and resources. And she really wants to see the Department of Workforce Solutions be a leader in and a facilitator of a competitive workforce in New Mexico. And we all know how important that is to benefit all the citizens of our state. So let's welcome Selena, Secretary Bussey. Thank you.
Grew up. And a clicker. I am technologically challenged, so my ability to talk into a microphone and work this is destined to fail, but either way, we're going to make our way through it. Good morning to everybody. As you go around the table, almost all of your entities, many of your faces are very familiar to me, so thank you guys for being here today. The presentation we started with something that was already alluded to and sort of what the vision for the Department of Workforce Solutions is. We talked about this earlier, but one of the things that I always focus on is really what our mission statement is. This is something that we revised this last year. Oftentimes, I think state agencies end up with mission statements and vision statements, and they're a lot of words, and people get lost in the words. And so what we really took the approach of was for us, if we had to boil it all down to some key things that we feel are really our charge in the department, what is that? And we kind of called it the E3 model, to educate, empower, and employ. We administer federal programs. They're complicated. They have a lot of regulations and rules and eligibility issues that are tied to them. And we're the beholder of all of that information. So we have a responsibility to educate all of the individuals that are being touched by those programs, to empower them by believing that they ultimately can be employed, gainfully employed, and provide for themselves and their families. And then ultimately to employ, because it is my personal belief that a job is empowering. There is value in work. And if somebody believes that at their very core, I think it does nothing more than show that to their family, and ultimately it then translates to generations after. So I think before we can get into sort of the picture of what New Mexico jobs look like today, we can never get away from the effects of the recession. Recovery has been slow, slow in our state, but slow as a nation. New Mexico, as we've talked about before, was one of the last states to really get into the recession. So, of course, we are one of the last states to come out of the recession. The economists will all tell you exactly what that means, but more than anything, I almost just think of it as like a car that tries to get started, and then once it does and it sputters along, that's sort of what our state has done in terms of the recession. The recession officially ended in June 2009. As I told the legislators yesterday, I said, go ask any business person or job seeker out there and see if they agree with you that the recession officially ended in June of 2009, and they're probably not going to agree with you at all. It is fiercely competitive out there, and we'll get into that. So I always think it's interesting to put that up there because that's what's talked about so very often. But I think in our state, at least, we would have a very different perspective if somebody asked us about the end of the recession. We always throw this in because it is true that unemployment insurance claims are always sort of a pulse, an indicator of what's going on out there in the economy. Our state spiked with unemployment insurance claim topping out at 60,000 individuals certifying for these benefits every week as compared to 12,000 prior to the recession. So you can see that it really did hit us hard. We are down in unemployment a full percentage point, down to 6.3%. But as all of you will see, that take a look at the labor market information that comes out from the department, that comes out from Bieber at UNM, we are not seeing in our state fast job growth. So even though our unemployment rate might be going down, one of the things that we're keenly concerned with is that our job rate is not growing fast enough to truly let us believe that that shrinking unemployment rate is a good indicator of recovery going on out there. And that bottom statistic, that bottom bullet point, is something that I'm personally concerned with. We spent a lot of time analyzing it inside of the department. The New Mexico labor force has shrunk 1 to 2%. What does that mean? Are these the people that no longer consider themselves actively looking for work? Are they those disgruntled and discouraged workers that everybody talks about. And I always hate that term of discouraged worker. I don't know what makes you discouraged. I'm discouraged every day when I have to get up and go to work and not lay in my pajamas all day. But I know that's not the technical definition. But the reality is we've lost 1% to 2% of our workforce since the recession. So if these people suddenly come back to our state, will we see a spike in the overall unemployment rate because they start reporting themselves as actively looking for work? Or have they really left our state for good? And what does that mean in terms of our ability to fill job vacancies that are out there currently? Graphs. My public information officer, who is an economist by trade, loves graphs, and she always sends them to me, and I always look at them and then have to look at them again and then have to look at them again to make sure that I'm interpreting them right. But this actually just charts out initial claims. So these are brand new claims for unemployment insurance. And it's 2010 in the red, 11 in blue, and then that orange color is 12. So as you can see in our state, we have very seasonal changes when it comes to unemployment insurance. Why? Well, we have large populations of migrant seasonal farm workers. That agriculture industry thrives in the world of unemployment insurance because it's very cyclical. They work for short periods of duration, and then they're on unemployment insurance. So you can see that those spikes remained relatively consistent even when we were still in the heart of the recession and then as we've been going into recovery. So the seasonal averages are still pretty much the same even now in 2012. And you can also see that what we are watching very closely is that initial claims are going down. They have been going down steadily for probably the last 6 months. We're still a little leery, though. I never want to be overly optimistic and say this is a sign of recovery. This means that it's getting better out there, because I hear too much of the fact that it's not, to use this as a sole indicator to say, yes, we are headed in the right direction. But it's something that we're watching for a number of reasons to understand what is the direct relationship between unemployment insurance claims and what's going on out in the overall job market. But one of the biggest impacts of the Great Recession, and we'll spend some time talking about this now, is that the labor market is a whole new ballgame for everybody involved, from the employer perspective to the job seeker to you all who are then responsible to be the bridge in between those two. It is definitely a different world than we've ever experienced. Industries have changed. The likelihood of reaching pre-recession employment and productivity levels varies by industry. Construction, a huge industry for our state, a loss of 1,300 jobs over the year. Construction shed jobs faster and at greater levels than any of our private sector industries. Very scary, because the reality most likely for our state is that we will never again reach pre-recession employment levels in construction. So what does that mean for that workforce? And we'll spend some time talking about, from a workforce perspective, when industries shrink and they never expand again, what is so very important to realize about those people and trying to work with them and their acquired skill sets to match them up in probably a new industry that they were never used to before. But also, professional and business services is down 3,400 jobs, and the public sector. The majority of job loss, with 4,500 employment decreases since just last year. The public sector is shedding jobs. We are shedding jobs at the federal level, the state level, the cities, the counties, and it is a trickle-down effect. And there's a number of reasons for that, and I always use our department to speak to that point. Our money is gone. Many state agencies blossomed when federal stimulus dollars were touching them and they were able to staff up in areas where they needed it. So there's one of the reasons that some of those losses can be accounted for. But also, technology changes things. We knew that better than anything in our department in a relatively old agency, and I don't say old always in number of years, but in very long-developed programs, they were always manual. And as you introduce technology, what used to require a person to get things done is now done automatically. And so you start to see attrition, not through layoffs always, but natural attrition of when somebody leaves, it's the computer that's doing their job now, and so you never replace those positions. And that, I think, is going to be something that, in particular in state government, many of our agencies are going to see at greater and greater degrees. So what is that going to mean for a public service sector that used to be so robust and probably overly robust in our state? And when technological advances come to full fruition, what does that mean when those jobs are no longer available in that sector anymore? But the bright spot at the end of it, New Mexico continues to gain in educational and health services, a very strong industry in our state. Yesterday, I was asked the question in terms of the Affordable Health Care Act, and ultimately what that will mean, because we'll get into some numbers later on in the presentation. And the numbers that we put forward in terms of our projections and our analysis in the jobs that will be available in that industry does not take into account the potential that is there with implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But jobs have changed. We've talked a little bit about industries in general, but now we know that jobs have changed. The downturn has forced many to expand their current job roles in offices where there were five people, and the recession caused the employer to have to let one go. The other four picked up the slack. No different than what you all experience every single day. When there's budget cuts and somebody goes, that work is always still there, and it ends up just getting spread amongst the people that remain. So we all might think that we drew the short straw and we get to do more work, but the reality is that we still have a job, and so for that we should always be grateful. But as we know, technology is playing a larger role regardless of the occupation that you're in. I don't think that you can find many occupations today that do not have a reliance on or a need for somebody to be technology savvy. And as I fully disclosed right off the beginning, not technology savvy. So I better keep my day job because I'm not going to be able to go out into the labor market and really try to be able to chase those kind of jobs that are going to want me to be successful when it comes to operating, understanding, or implementing technology in an office. Doing more with less. It's an age-old term. This is nothing new. We've been talking about it forever, but I don't think it's ever been more in effect, active than it is today of doing more with less. It's simply an expectation out there. Expanded job descriptions, more demands and duties. Competition for jobs. You could probably even cut off the second part of that sentence. Jobs with benefits is heightened. It is just flat-out competition for jobs, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Education credentials and years of experience are no longer guaranteed indicators of a qualified applicant. And why? Because the labor force is flooded with them. Flooded with people with education credentials, flooded with people with years and years of experience, and they are out there and hungry for jobs. The evolution of jobs. I use this as an example because it came out in a New York Times article that was really talking about STEM, but it's one of these terms, and I equate it to green. When everybody started talking about green and going green and green jobs, and then the cynics started raising their hands and saying, define green, and nobody ever really could. I would argue that STEM is the same thing. We know what it stands for. We know what the acronym means. But when you say STEM jobs, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, one, I always like to add in the H and actually call it STEM and put in healthcare because that's absolutely included in this all the time. But what we talk about is that jobs of the past have evolved, and welding is a primary example. How did people used to learn how to weld? Very blue-collar, middle-class jobs. But they learned it in high school shop classes, they worked in a family business, they worked on a farm, and they came up through the ranks, sometimes through apprenticeship programs, sometimes in a vocational training program, but they came up through the ranks, but they always capped out at a certain skill level because that was the nature of that occupation at the time. But now, welding is a STEM job. It's a job that requires knowledge of science, math, engineering, and mathematics. And the article actually went even further because they were talking with a welding shop, which was incredibly interesting to me, and they said, today, I need a welder who can understand metallurgy, modern cleaning and brushing techniques, and how different metals and gases, pressures and temperatures have to be combined to produce the perfect weld. That is all STEM related in a welding job. So when we start talking about the roles of our community colleges and our understanding of jobs, especially when it comes to the public workforce system, if you're looking at an applicant that wants to be a welder, it isn't just saying, well, yeah, they're a pretty good construction-related type person. I think they'll fit. Probably don't have a high school diploma or GED. Maybe they do, but they're a good candidate. Not anymore. Not anymore because the job demands too much and it has changed too much. Employer perspectives have changed. Coming out of the recession has been unlike any others, and employers now are relatively risk-averse. They don't want to take on risk. They're still uneasy. They still have the lashings on the back. Their bank accounts are still suffering, and they're just generally uncomfortable with doing anything that could be looked at in terms of high risk. So therefore, they obviously are looking at new ways of doing business. It is all about efficiency and effectiveness. How efficient can I be and how effective can I be with as little as possible? This is not the time when you decide to overstaff. It is not the time that you decide to invest in things that are not guaranteed indicators of gaining efficiency or effectiveness. Employers just simply are not going to do it this day and age. They want to be able to predict job performance. Why? Because turnover costs are high. We talk about this all the time with businesses. Go ask any business, small, medium, large, doesn't matter. And the business will be able to put a dollar figure to what it costs for them to hire. And more importantly, the more drastic figure is how expensive it is to make a bad hire. When they can give you those numbers, it means I don't want to have to do that. If I can lower the cost of hiring, or if I can reduce the amount of bad hires that I have, those are the kind of things that I'm interested in if I'm in a business. That's about it. They're faced with continued risk and uncertainty. If you're in a business, you're looking at increases in unemployment insurance liability. That's me. I'm the tax collector. I implement their rates based on their history with unemployment insurance, and most employers today have had more experience and greater hits to those benefits and to those accounts than they've ever had in the past, and they're desperately looking for ways to try to reduce that. They're rehiring at a slower pace. You can look at businesses that laid off, and you hear all of these positive things about where they're going, but look at their hiring practices. They are hiring slower and at lesser numbers than they ever did in the past. They're utilizing temp services, and Jeff will talk a lot about this new world of work and why entities such as Manpower are such in demand with businesses. And they're limiting technical advances and capital investments. And as I mentioned yesterday with the legislators here, if you're in the world of economic development, that is disastrous. You need businesses out there investing in infrastructure, investing in capital. You need them buying land. You need them buying buildings. You need them building new buildings. It is what drives economic development, and I think that that's one of the things that we're seeing in our state is you're just not seeing those kind of investments today. We talk about our job seekers, and all of you are keenly familiar with job seekers. Their challenges have changed. Older workers are staying in jobs longer because they simply can't afford to retire. There's greater competition for even entry-level positions. Yesterday, it was a big topic of conversation, not only in the apprenticeship realm, but something that Mr. Parker will mention in his presentation and myself. Jobs that used to be available for our youth, probably the world that all of us came up through when we first got our work permits at the age of 14 and started working, are no longer options for our youth. And that is what, to me, is incredibly scary, because to me, that's where I learned the value of work, was when I actually got out there and started working. But when you see our young people trying to go and get those part-time jobs and summer jobs, and they're standing in line with people with bachelor's degrees and 20 years of work experience and a whole host of work-related skills, what is going to happen to our youth population when they remain unemployed for drastically longer periods of time while they're still finishing out their education, hopefully, but they won't have work experience to complement that education? And that's scary to me. And so it's interesting when you start to take a look at the fact that not only are older workers staying in jobs, but really that the competition for those entry-level jobs of what used to go to our young people isn't even competition anymore. They don't even stand a chance. We know it's no longer the norm where people work for one company or one employer their entire working life. People don't get a job at the plant and work there for 30 years and get their watch at retirement. It just doesn't happen anymore. People change industries. They change them rapidly. And more than anything, there's a willingness out there in our labor force to change industries if they just know how to do it. And people are changing employers. Even in the same industries, they change employers many times and in very short periods of time. And if you're somebody who hires, I'm concerned about that. Because when I look at resumes and I look at work history, the fact that you might do this with employers isn't a good sign to me. It doesn't jump off the paper and say, oh, look, Selena's versatile, and she's really aggressive, and she really wants to move up in the world. It says, Selena probably has attendance issues. She probably has issues dealing with management. She might have personal things going on, because why does she have a new job every 6 months? We know challenges continue for our job seekers, the long-term unemployed. You are talking about some of the worst stigmas that are going on out there in terms of our long-term unemployed. Concerns over their work ethic, concerns over their soft skills, concerns over what they've actually been doing in terms of actively looking for work during this economic downturn, and it is glaring on a resume. When you start to take a look at gaps in employment of a year, 2 years, or more, how does a job seeker explain that? And if you're in the workforce system and you work with these people personally, how do you help them to explain that in a way that you believe it can be attested to? That to an employer, you can help that person communicate that they're not damaged goods and that there's a reason and a rationale for it, but that there is as much of a reason and a rationale why the employer should give them a chance to get back into the workforce. And that, I think, is a huge challenge for those of us that are working with the workforce today, and we know that there are so many of them out there. Soft skills carry more weight. We talked a little bit about this in yesterday's presentation, being able to gauge soft skills. And my elementary explanation for soft skills is everything we can't touch. You can't measure customer service. There might be surveys out there. Would you please rate Selena Bussey on her customer service today? 1 being the lowest and 5 being the highest. Doesn't let an employer really understand of how you can gauge customer service when it comes to hiring, or being able to communicate it to a person at an interview of customer service is important to us. Do you value customer service? Yes. Okay, moving on in the interview, that's about as far as you can get, which is why soft skills is always such a hard thing to gauge in job seekers and a very hard thing for employers to understand how vitally important it is to their business. But more employers, I think, are getting in tune with it because from the employer perspective, soft skills were a given. You develop soft skills by growing up. You develop soft skills by becoming an adult and going out there into the real world. But employers today, from everything that I hear, are doubting that life and the process by which people are going through is really instilling in them the soft skills to be productive out there in the workforce. And to me, that's a big question of how do we solve that? You can't send Selena to a soft skills class and expect that I'm going to come out of it and I'm going to understand work ethic and reliability and trustworthiness and honesty. You have it or you don't. So how do we get to a place in our society through not only education but the public workforce system and us in government to where we know what soft skills mean in the workplace and we get back to a state in our world where soft skills are being developed in life and not supposed to be developed in the workplace? And here's my favorite word, and we talk about this all the time in the department, employability. And it means coming to the table with a complete package. Your education, to the degree that you need it, knowledge, and skills. And it is very difficult this day and age for people to really understand, am I employable? Not can I go get a job, but am I truly an employable person because I possess these things at the aptitude level needed to go and get a job and be successful at the job? Transferable skills. As we talked about what the recession has done in industries that have shrunk and are probably never coming back, this has probably never been as important as it is today. Industries that will not or may not reach pre-recession employment levels, individuals' ability to understand their transferable skills is key. Computer skills, communication and writing skills, management experience, customer service, locating information, researching, and the always important critical thinking skills. If a job applicant, if a job seeker, if somebody who is underemployed, if somebody who's on social services cannot understand the skills that they have and how those transfer into various industries and various jobs within industries, they are lost. And it is going to take a lot of wraparound services around them to help them translate that those skills mean something in other industries where there is job potential. And I use the construction world as an example all the time. We have a whole lot of construction people out there that may never have a construction job again. Electricians, iron workers, carpenters, plumbers, they came up through a trade, and the trade exists, but the job demand does not in our state right now, and it may never come back. But we have blossoming worlds and jobs that are showing signs of improvement in manufacturing and elsewhere. So how do you sit with that carpenter and educate him of what skills he actually has that relate to the manufacturing shop? And that is a challenge. Job seekers have to have the in-depth understanding of their skill set. They have to be able to speak to it, but they are going to have less and less of time in order to be able to demonstrate it when they're actually given the opportunity. So where we end up when we talk about all of the changes that have gone through from job seekers to industries to employers, we always come back to the same topic, which is skills-based hiring. We talk about skills-based hiring because we realize that for employers, it's so important to somehow, some way, be able to assess the employability of candidates with specific hard skills, technical skills, and aptitude in order for them to be successful for the job. So we talk about skills-based hiring, skills-based assessments becoming the new norm in hiring and training. And we talk about this for a number of reasons. If an employer is flooded with people with education credentials and they can't correlate those education credentials to the job as they know it today, does the education credential mean what it used to? When you have employers that can talk about individuals coming to them with an education credential at whatever level, and that person still ends up being a bad hire, what's the first thing that the employer says? Education didn't mean anything. So it's never to question the education system or to downplay the value of education when it comes to someone being employable, but it really has become an apples and oranges comparison. You have education in one hand, and it stands for everything that it always has. But its role in the workplace and its role in being a sole indicator of, I have this education credential, that's why you should hire me, doesn't get you there anymore. So when we talk about skills-based assessments being a new norm and an opportunity for employer, why? Because it assesses your knowledge, but not knowledge from an educational perspective, which is you studied all these things and memorized all these things and you took a test and you got a degree, but rather it's the aptitude and cognitive skills you have to put your current knowledge into use to find something that you didn't have. So we talk all the time in the department about someone being able to possess two pieces of information and using those two pieces of information to go find 10 others. That is aptitude. That is skill. And those are cognitive skills that an education credential alone solely does not measure anymore. But it also helps to identify skills gaps. We've been doing this in our department already when we're trying to transition into a new system. I have a whole lot of people who have worked there for a very long time. They are my subject matter experts. I need them to know everything there is to know about a program like unemployment insurance. But introduce a new form of technology, and what you find is you had a lot of people that were subject matter experts about the old system. They knew how to work it. They knew how to work around it to get the work done. But they knew less about the program itself than you ever would have imagined. That's a skills gap. I have to get away from someone being technology reliant and letting technology lead to those decisions and force them to demonstrate that they have an understanding of the program when that's what's vitally needed when it comes to something like unemployment insurance. But that skills gap is something that's vitally important even to a job seeker. If I know that I constantly am pursuing jobs that say I need to have applied mathematics, I need to be able to demonstrate that I have aptitude in applied mathematics, and I don't quite understand what that is, but it keeps coming up. If I'm able to gauge where my skill gap is in that, then I know what I'm shooting for when I go enroll at the community college. I'm not one of those individuals who finds themselves on the doorstep of a training provider or a higher education institution who says, I just need to sign up. Because everywhere I go, I don't have the skills or I don't have the experience or I don't have the education to go get those jobs. So I'm here and I'm hoping you can give that to me. This is a different perspective in that individuals can find out unique skills that they have a gap in and then identifies ways where they can skill themselves up to be able to secure those jobs. We're doing this as a department with the support of the Workforce Connection team that's here today from all over the state through WorkKeys, which is an assessment product, and it's not to promote the product, but rather it's all around the approach and the mentality of skills-based hiring and using the assessments that WorkKeys has developed to profile jobs, to find out what it is in various industries with various jobs and what are the skills that are actually needed, what are the cognitive skills, the hard skills that people have to be successful in those jobs. So what does that do for the employer? Well, if we rewind a couple of slides and we talk about what employers are risk adverse to, they're risk adverse to the hiring costs. Show them how you can lower your hiring costs. They're risk adverse to bad hires. Show them how through these various tools and a skills-based hiring approach, they can reduce their risk of making a bad hire. It's not really a sell. It's an identifying with an employer what their challenges are and saying there are other ways to go about this to see if it actually solves the problem that you have. Traditional training, and this is something that you hear a lot about, old training programs, old concepts like apprenticeship that have been around since the dark ages are more relevant and valuable today than ever before. Why? because employers will tell you, I need a person with the aptitude to be good, and I will train them myself, because that is the world that employers have found themselves in. They still see value in training that goes on outside of their place of employment. They find value in the education system, but when it comes to bringing in an entry-level person and finding out if they're going to meet the test, they turn to themselves. Why? Because they know their business better than anybody. No community college will ever know the business of a manufacturing plant better than the plant manager. Nobody ever will. Not the public workforce system, not me, not anyone. And when employers can attest to the fact that they know how to train to the level in which they need that employee to be successful, it becomes our job to be able to stand back and say, now, can we listen to them? Can we listen to them and then find a way to make our tools, our programs, our services work with that and together with it, as opposed to standing in opposition to it and finding fault in it? And I think that the apprenticeship model does that better than anybody. Many people know about on-the-job training and essentially is on-the-job training. This job is on-the-job training. Nobody goes to school to become a cabinet secretary. Nobody knows what the job even entails until you show up and the job presents itself to you. And I think that most of you find yourself in those kind of jobs too. They had a title and they wrote up a paragraph and it sounded pretty interesting and you said, I think I can do that. And then you get in the job and find out what it's really all about. And they always find that catch-all phrase at the end to say other duties as assigned, which is why I find myself here today, because it's other duties as assigned. But it's what you do. And it's, do you have the aptitude to find yourself in that on-the-job training experience and say, I can do this. I can do it because there's enough people around that I can go to for resources to make me successful. But most often, you're going to have a mentor. And the on-the-job training models and the apprenticeship models always rely on that. You're always going to have an expert. You're always going to have a technician. You're always going to have a mentor that can show you the way. It's, are you willing to lean on them, learn from them, and be guided by them? And if you're not able to do that, these programs will never be successful, because it's not about someone knowing everything all on their own. It is about their ability to learn from others. We get into the numbers. Top projected jobs by education level, and we start at the low end. High school and limited training. Low wages and where New Mexico's greatest job openings are. So what does that tell us about our state? And Jeff and I were having a long conversation about this yesterday and what New Mexico always wants to be when it grows up, and we want all of these Fortune 500 businesses to relocate here, and we want corporate headquarters to be here. That's not our state, guys. It probably never will be, and that's okay. It's okay if you recognize the strengths that we have and use them to our advantage to make our workforce competitive, whether it's for the entry-level jobs that exist out there or the higher-end jobs that we struggle with filling today. And when we see openings across the board, it is true that even with a 6.3% unemployment rate in our state, even with 16,000 people certifying for unemployment insurance benefits every week, we have thousands and thousands of jobs that are open. And some of them have been open for a long time because we simply can't find the candidate to fill the job. And that, I think, is the challenge of all of us that are in this room. There are jobs. Are they the ideal jobs that we always want to have? No. I think as a state, we would all agree we always want to have high wage, better jobs for everybody. But we have to recognize the data that tells us that we're just not there. So as you can see, these jobs run the gamut, everything from bookkeeping to cashiers, medical assistants, teacher assistants. So you touch a variety of industries, education, healthcare, retail, so on and so forth. But they're all on the entry-level side. But these are those entry-level jobs, again, that we used to talk about with our youth and their ability to get those jobs. And now competition being so much more drastic. We get into the middle range when it comes to vocational, technical, and apprenticeship training and education. You see everything from some of your more traditional blue-collar type jobs, automotive service technicians, diesel engine mechanics, dental hygienists, insurance agents. It runs the gamut here, but as you can see, job openings across the board. Average wages still continuing to go up, but generally speaking, across the board, job openings. And then on up to your top projected jobs by education level, and these are your four-year degrees and higher. And again, job openings across the board. Big ones, obviously, in registered nurses and in the education sector with teachers. And I always think that that's interesting because we talk about the huge job openings for post-secondary instructors, elementary instructors, and things like that. But then you've got districts laying teachers off because their population is shrinking. And again, that's something that I think you're going to see in a slide later that talks about the shifting population in our state. And when population shifts, it has a direct impact on the education system in those small communities and what happens in terms of individuals losing their job, even in what has traditionally been seen as a very secure place. I'm a teacher. I'm always going to have a job. Maybe. All bets are off now, folks, and everything that used to be seen as a guaranteed job until retirement, all bets are off. Public service is no different. Registered nurses, though, I always use that as sort of an example of what's so huge in our state when we talk about the job opportunities out there. I don't know that there's much better of a career ladder than in healthcare. And you can look at healthcare from nursing to actual practitioners to every specialized piece that you can find out there. And you find entry-level, high school diploma or less, no experience openings. And that same person with a little bit of help from higher education and some on-the-job training can find themselves doubling and tripling their annual earnings within a five-year period of time. Those are the opportunities that are there. But I think what our state has lacked for so very long is a true understanding of the career ladder out there and helping job seekers navigate their way through it. I used to work with nursing homes. We were trying to develop apprenticeship programs in nursing homes. And why? Because they had such huge turnover with certified nursing assistants. These poor people, God bless their souls, $9 an hour. $9 an hour to go into a senior citizen facility and work with the elderly who have some of the greatest health challenges in the world and everything else that goes along with it for $9 an hour. And they always, if you talk to the staff, if you talk to the registered nurse that was running the operation, they always had the same struggle. We don't know how to convey to them what the next step is. It's always about, well, go get another certification and go get another certification. But we don't need that certification here because we've already got somebody doing that, so you can go get it and then just go to another facility and work there. So they all shared. Even in Albuquerque, as big as it is, those facilities could talk to each other and find 30% of their workforce from a year ago over at that other facility. Fast forward a year and they wouldn't be at that facility, they'd be at another facility. And oftentimes, no better trained, without any greater credentials, but they chased 10 cents an hour. They chased 20 cents an hour. And that, I think, is a huge shift, especially when we have such shortages in healthcare across the board of how do we as a state get away from that and support what's going to happen with our job seekers when they're interested in the healthcare arena. And we end by just focusing on the situation of employability altogether. When we talk about jobs in our state, it is absolutely about the total package. Education level, skill sets, and overall employability of our workforce. And it is of primary importance not only to the department, but it should be the primary importance to our state because we have challenges across the board. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's give her a hand. I'm lucky enough to get to hear the presentations.